From your radio today, this is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
You can be ready for everything, you know. War is war, bullet is bullet, so better don't think about it. Better to be concentrated on this battle right now, this minute, this second.
I instantly knew when it happened for me that I was not going to tell. That I would not go to the guards, I would not tell. And that wasn't because I knew the rapist. I still have no idea who it was, but I know that they knew me. It was a fear, but it was an overwhelming sense of shame.
You've held this secret for a long time, but you've told us now.
And we'll start on the news at one, and a band of Ukrainian men who left their homes and families in Ireland to fight in the war in their homeland. Brian Dobson spoke to Roman Protsenko from the front line.
A small group of Ukrainian men who travelled from Ireland are now part of a volunteer battalion in Ukraine. Among them is a 53-year-old furniture delivery driver who travelled from Dundrum in Dublin to fight in the war. I spoke to Roman Protsenko, who's part of the Irish unit.
We are a volunteer battalion. Name is Bratstvo, translating like something like friendship. We are 53 years old. We are working like after attack. We cleaning from Russian troops villages. We checking all houses, backyards, underground, attics, everything around. We're looking for Russian soldiers who try to hide themselves. And we're checking for bombs and granates hiding as well. It's very serious work because many people and civilian people after victory will be walking around. It's possible to step for some bombs, you know. So our job is it's like cleaners, you know.
You served, I think, previously in what was the Soviet army back in the 1980s. And why did you decide to leave your home in Ireland to travel to Ukraine to take part in this?
I can't imagine like some Russian boots will be stay on the cemetery where, for example, my mother and my dad and my father. So I can't imagine like soldier troops will be walking by street of my native city, Kremenchuk. So it's unbelievable for me. But you know what they're doing now in Ukraine? Do you know the situation of the Bucha?
Yes.
City is completely destroyed. A lot of 100 civilian people killed. Oh, my God. Now I'm shaking now, like, you know, answering for you. Just to stay on a warm house, on doomed room, and looking for news or by TV, it's not easy. I could not even work, you know. I working, but when I driving, I looking for any little news about Ukraine, about war with Russia. So it was very difficult for me. And after 3 days, I have decision to go to Ukraine, and I spoke with my family and say about my decision.
And your family supported the decision, but they're presumably also concerned for you, I imagine.
I have a daughter, son, and wife, and everybody they have a different emotion about it. My son said, actually, I would like to go to Ukraine myself. So I said to him, thank you, son, but you know, somebody from them should be stay with family. You are young, so you're supposed to stay with family. My wife. Hi, Tatiana. I love you very much. And she told what, no, Roman, stay at home. So thousands Ukrainian youngest guys will be defend our country. My daughter, she's very smart. She spoke with me from another side. She told, look, father, you can do your job here in Ireland and you can... work like volunteers here. We can buy something to send to Ukraine, like food, like medicine, like cars, buses, you know, and send it. So you can do your job here in Ireland. She's very smart. Hi, Dasha. but, you know, I ask it to my family. Thank you very much, but please save my decision with me. Don't ask me to stay at home because it's not easy for me myself. My family just said, yes, okay, you can do it.
Are you fearful Do you worry about what the future might hold for you?
Well, yes, of course. Everybody like life. Everybody won't enjoy on this life, not on the future. Of course, but, you know, you can be ready for everything, you know. War is war, bullet is bullet. So better don't think about it. Better to be concentrated on this battle right now, this minute, this second.
Roman Protsenko speaking to Brian Dobson from the News at 1. And on the live line, the pain and long-term damage of sexual assault and rape.
And there's been a really strong reaction to that very distressing case that came from the courts yesterday, where four men were convicted of multiple sexual assaults of a 17-year-old girl in a car 5 years ago. Three of those men were convicted of rape, a fourth convicted of sexual assault. A fifth man, who had also been present, pleaded guilty of rape before that case went to trial. We know the judge yesterday said and paid tribute to the very, very brave young woman who was the victim of that case. And I want to go now to another very brave woman, Niamh Ní Gonal. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Niamh, I know you don't want to go into the details of this, but I know that you will feel a huge solidarity with the victim in this case.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, it's always tricky when you read these cases. But certainly, I actually remember kind of when I started reading a few details about it just over a month ago, and I do remember feeling ill kind of when reading about it. So, yeah, I think it's a hard time for anyone who's had these experiences or who knows someone who has. And I only hope that she's doing okay and that she has good support around her at the moment.
And going back, one of the issues in this case was like the length of time that girl had to, wait for that trial, for her case to come to trial. Like you've actually been, you were not only through the criminal justice system, but you pursued a civil case as well. So you are really familiar with all the issues she will have been confronted with.
Absolutely. But I think in this case, the weight that she had was absolutely appalling. Like it was a 5 or 6 year wait, and that's just within the kind of confines of the criminal justice system, where as a witness you are a witness, and realistically the state don't have a case generally speaking without someone coming forward. So she would have been required to not speak to anyone, not divulge anything to anyone, or to very, very select people, for fear of prejudicing the case. And I can't imagine, I didn't have to go through that long of a wait for the criminal justice system, though it was long. I can't imagine having to hold all of that in. How do you heal? How do you kind of process? And I think Donnie made a really good point, while at the same time you're trying to kind of remember the details and try and remember what you said in a statement. And there's that, the idea of kind of memories coming back in later. And did I say that in the interview? So 6 years or 5 years to wait with that is an enormous burden for her, I can only imagine anyway.
And to know, because of course we all, have seen other court cases. We've all, mm-hmm. seen the commentary around them and know that, defence barristers are going to question you really closely about your story and about, how you present those events. And as you say, to try and keep the whole event straight in your head, when actually what you really want to be doing is moving on from it.
Yeah, it's a really hard one, and it's hard for the criminal justice system not to be re-traumatising, because it's requiring you to remember exactly what you said in a moment or in a series of interviews with the guards. And that's an incredibly confronting thing to do. And oftentimes things you remember something else later, or you wonder, did you say that the right way? So I think, I certainly recall waiting to go through the criminal justice system. And I think I was already cross-examining and interrogating myself, and how would I say something or how would I come across? And I think that's the product of the society that we live in, that we live in a society that asks victims and survivors why they were in the situation, as opposed to really holding those responsible for who commit those kinds of actions.
And Katie spoke about getting support from the Rape Crisis Centre with Niamh.
That's the 24-hour helpline for the Rape Crisis Centre. That's 1-800-77-8888. 1-800-77-8888. Because I do think that, you know, the reporting on this case that just came to a conclusion yesterday, and even just our conversations here now, Niamh, it will almost inevitably trigger memories and trigger emotions with people who maybe have never spoken about what's happened to them.
Absolutely. And I think the real power of a helpline, and just to say this for people, is that you can pick it up and you can dial the number and you can put the phone down and you can, you know, you always have power. And I know that it is so difficult to say the words out loud or to wonder, why am I feeling this? Because maybe sometimes for people, these things are touching nerves, they're activating something that they're unaware of why it is or what may or may not have happened. You don't have to know. If you're impacted, it's enough to know that you should chat with someone. And the beauty of a helpline is that it's completely anonymous. They'll never know who you are. But I think the important thing is to not sit in silence if that is making you uncomfortable or distressed, and that there is help there.
Niamh there, then Sinead called Katie with her story.
Sinead, you will understand what Niamh was saying there. You will have your feelings for this girl at the centre of this horrible case that we've been talking about today. But you haven't spoken about it before.
Recently and in patches over the years, I'm actually partly smiling listening to Niamh, not obviously in a happy light. But it's ironic to me that she and I share so many similarities, but also polar opposites. Regarding the girl in the case yesterday, I struggle to even know what to say to her other than, don't be me.
Explain, Sinead. Tell us your story. It goes back a long time.
Oh, yes. I am 42 years old. I was raped. I still have to swallow when I say that. I was raped when I was 18 years old.
Take your time.
I apologise. Sorry, I didn't think this was going to happen so soon. I will compose myself. Apologies. I was on a night out with my friends in a nightclub in a town in rural Ireland. I had a silly argument. I can never remember what it was about. It's a long time ago, 24 years, with the guy that I was seeing at the time.
You were just a teenager at that stage, didn't
you? Oh, I was 18. It was the summer. So I was in leaving cert.
Right.
And it was supposed to be a summer of fun. So I remember actually we hadn't got our leaving cert results yet. So, you know, everything was still quite carefree, and that's the way it should be when you're 18. In any event, I had this silly little argument with the guy that I was seeing, and I haven't changed much in that respect. I got the hump and I stormed off home.
Yeah, on your own.
On my own. It would be about a 7 or 8 minute walk from that nightclub to the door of my family home. I was about, I don't know, I haven't been there in a long time, but I would say maybe 10 doors from home. There was a walkway with a slope, and I thought I heard something. The whole street was well lit, but in this one particular spot, the light wasn't working. And I remember walking along, talking nearly to myself, not out loud, but in my head, about the argument that I just had.
And, because just to say, like, just to get people the picture of this, you didn't think you were taking any big risk here. This is a small town.
You
felt totally safe.
This was something me, my siblings, all of my friends, male and female, would have done all of the time. Everybody on that street knew each other. All of the families would have been friendly. It was extremely well lit. It was a good part of town. In fact, the whole town was a good town. You know, there was no major crime or anything like that. And even though it is 24 years ago, that's not that long ago. I'm only 42 now. It's not like I'm some old lady, you know. It's really not that long ago. I remember those Alco Pops were out at the time, and I'd had about three of them. I wasn't drunk. And I even feel compelled to say that today. And I feel like for the last 24 years, in my head, definitely, and towards the public, that I have to justify and make sure everybody knows that I wasn't drunk.
Because we can just say now, it wouldn't matter if you were drunk. That has absolutely nothing to do with what happened next.
And as Niamh says, there's things that you know in your head, but you're still worried about perception.
Yeah.
And that comes from, I guess, obviously inside, but it certainly comes from society. And it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I've always known it was wrong. I've always known I wasn't in the wrong. But it's like an angel and a devil on your shoulder, and they fight each other all of the time. And that was my barrier to never speaking about it. I was punched in the face when I heard a noise. I was completely shocked and disorientated. I'd never been hit in my life. And I was raped. I went home afterwards. I went to the nearest freezer. I took out a bag of peas. And I applied it to my face to make sure that there would be no mark in the morning. I got up earlier than normal. I had a summer job. And I made sure I was out of the house before my parents got up. I cannot explain why, but I instantly knew when it happened for me that I was not going to tell. That I would not go to the guards. I would not tell. And that wasn't because I knew the rapist. I still have no idea who it was, but I know that they knew me. It was a fear, but it was an overwhelming sense of shame. And I went to work and I pretended like nothing was wrong. And for the majority of the last 24 years, I have pretended that nothing was wrong. Over the years, I have had one too many drinks on a night out or whatever. I actually don't even really drink that much anymore. But over the years, when I was younger, I would have and become a little melancholy and told one or two people. But I would never say the word rape. I used to say things like I was attacked, just not able to deal with it.
And Katie spoke to Sinead about her strength and finding support with the Rape Crisis Centre.
Absolutely.
And well, it's incredible credit to you, Sinead, that even in that, you know, through all that trauma that your thoughts were for other women, strangers even, that you know, that's some says something about you, I think.
Thank you for the compliment. I don't feel that way a lot of days, but I will take that compliment. Thank you.
Sinead, as I say, you obviously, you've held this secret for a long mm-hmm. time from most people, but you've told us now. You're on the airwaves. You're telling this story.
It feels incredible. I didn't know when I woke up this morning that I was doing this today, but it feels like a relief. And the reason I did it today is obviously to try and help other people, but I selfishly did it for myself. I don't do a lot of things to myself, and I've learned this year that I owe it to myself. Before Aisling Murphy died, about 2 months before, I was on a walk by a river myself, and a man was... Oh my God, the man was so far away from me. And I never had a panic attack in my life, but ultimately I had a panic attack. Just made notions in my head that something bad was going to happen with this man and totally freaked myself out. I came home, I was just in shattered. And I knew then that I could not control this beast anymore and I needed help, professional help. I talked it through with my husband, and that very day I contacted the Rape Crisis Centre, and they are the reason that I'm able to talk about this today. even after the first session, just to say the words out loud and give me little things to work on and build my confidence and just listen and be an ear. And sometimes, like when you write something down in black and white, it's hard to believe what you're reading. Yeah. But I had been so silent so long and so ashamed. To hear myself say the words and talk about it over and over has just done something great to me. I don't know what it is, but it has done good things.
Sinead, and I'll give out that Rape Crisis Centre number again, 1-800-77-8888.
And I'll repeat that, 1-800-77-8888. That's Sinead on the live line with Katie Hannon. And in the morning, helping people to help people driven out of their homes in Ukraine.
More than 7 weeks of war and the kind of violence and cruelty that ABC reporter James Longman was telling us about have forced more than a quarter of people there to flee their homes, half the country's children. Millions have left the country. More than 20,000 people are here and more are expected. Many are living in hotels, but also in houses offered by people here and sharing homes with people here. Dr. Mirini Rahalig is a senior lecturer and associate professor and is program director of the Professional Masters of Social Work and head of subject for social work at UCD. She's been writing this week about the needs for supports for hosts, and she's with us now. Dr. Nirahali, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
More calls to people offering to share their homes with Ukrainians are going to be made today. What can people prepare for?
I think the first thing to say is that it's great to see the generosity of Irish people wanting to step up and to help. But I guess the reality is that this is really complex work. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to be hosting families of refugee background who've never worked with refugees before, potentially never met refugees before. And, I guess one of the things that I think people need to really think about is to think about how they're going to manage the trauma that a person has been through. And oftentimes we kind of think that what needs to happen is we need to say to somebody, okay, you know, tell me what's happened. But in reality, many refugees, when they arrive here, will be focused on the practicalities of settling in. And usually it's not going to be appropriate to kind of probe in relation to what's happened in their past experience, you know, in their journey and so on. So I think people need to be open to listening, but they also need to be really comfortable with kind of silence or with people who, you know, won't want to talk about what they've gone through. I think the second thing to think about is just to remember that, you know, each refugee is an individual. And sometimes we have this label of a refugee, and obviously we see a lot of media coverage of the horrific things that people are going through, and we see people maybe just with that lens. Whereas in reality, of course, the people who are arriving here they're also, you know, mothers or friends or aunts or their children. They're children who go to school. They're people with careers and with hobbies and who went out at weekends and so on. So I think seeing the person as an individual with all of those identities is really important. And I suppose related to that then too is just around issues of privacy. So sometimes we see, you know, photos being shared of people, you know, who are being hosted, and we're generally curious, I suppose, nation. So it's likely that if there's somebody moving in next door to you from Ukraine, that you're going to be asking your neighbour, oh, you know, what's happened, and tell me about them. So I think the hosts have a real responsibility to respect the privacy of the person with them, and to recognise as well that, you know, when you ask maybe the family staying with you, is it okay if I put your photograph up on Facebook or on Twitter, that the person who's staying with you probably doesn't really feel that they can say no, because you're hosting them. So just recognising, I suppose, that power dynamic that's at play as well.
The Irish Times were reporting earlier this week that some Irish families who had taken in refugees had returned them to facilities like City West, telling volunteers there that they were unable to cope. What supports could be offered?
So, I mean, I think having access to some kind of training to prepare people for what's ahead of them and for what it involves. So, you know, for example, I mean, it's a different kind of scenario, but if somebody was going to foster a child, they would be put through, you know, they go through a long assessment process to make sure that that's right for them. Now, this isn't a fostering arrangement. It's different. But at the same time, you're having a family live in your home. So people need to, I think, have information about the reality of what's involved in that. And then they need to have information about what, you know, they need to have access to training and supports to be able to help them to get through that. So that might be, for example, you know, the state providing some, or, you know, maybe in conjunction with NGOs, and I think there is some preparation underway for this, providing some basic information about the kinds of ways in which they can respond to people who've come, providing some practical information about, you know, what people might want, like is it English language classes, pointing people in the direction of relevant supports. Okay. And I suppose, you know, just, yeah, making sure that people have access as well to support for themselves, because it's going to be emotionally demanding on the hosts as well.
Dr. Moira Ní-Rathaillíog from UCD's Social Work Department with Gavin Jennings in the morning. Then later on Today with Claire Byrne, reporter Brian O'Connell was in Blarney GAA Club to see how a transformed changing room is helping to bring essentials to Ukrainian families who've just arrived in the area. Local woman Kate Durant spoke to Brian.
We're down in Blarney GAA changing rooms, actually, which is now our Ukrainian shop more, isn't it? People are still changing here, but they're changing in very different ways.
These are the dressing rooms as we walk in, and it's now being repurposed.
There isn't a shop in Cork for people coming in, and as you know, Brian, they're coming in with nothing, as in literally nothing. Dasha had 10 minutes just to put a few things into a tiny backpack, and that's it. So we went out, and thanks to the... We've got a great community here, as you know, and we purchased all the new intimate items, like obviously underwear and socks and toiletries, and then people donated stuff, really good stuff.
It is like a shop. I mean, you have girls aged 5 to 7, girls 4 to 5.
So there's the changing rooms, there's the rail, there's the bags, because we want people to really fill their bags. It's really sad we don't have a men's room because there are no men coming, and that's actually, when you think about it more, that's devastating. Dating, isn't it? The harsh realities, you know, and people are here and they're so upbeat, yet you know they don't know how their men folk are, their elderly parents. 6 weeks ago they were sitting in their homes like we all are, and now they're over here, the kids are in school in a foreign language, living in somebody else's house, which however nice your host is, has got to be a real challenge, and going off for job interviews. You just take your hat off to them, wouldn't you?
Who's arriving in this morning?
We've got 62 guests coming from a hotel in Kinsale where they're staying. I don't know how long for. And there was a guy there and he couldn't leave. I couldn't understand why he was so happy to see the stuff come in, but he actually couldn't leave the hostel. He'd no shoes. He'd worn them out walking to get wherever he had to get to. So it's hard to give that kind of bit of reality check. You know, you're going around and we're all smiling and this is so lovely, but the reality is it isn't lovely.
That's Kate Durant there. And as the bus arrived with 60 Ukrainians on board, Brian talked to some of them about fleeing the war, including Dasha, who's 32. You'll have heard Kate mention her there, a former gymnastics instructor from Kiev.
Everybody in Ukraine were talking about the war, but nobody believed because, like, we always thought that Russia... Oh, come on, we speak Russians. I can speak it. We have common traditions. And now... Russia doesn't exist for me like a country, like a nation. I don't want to communicate in Russian, but before, that was okay.
Extraordinary how much has changed. And the decision for you to leave, when did you take that?
I lived in Kyiv in bomb shelters for 9 days. And it was getting really worse. And when they occupied Kherson, it was... very scary because we started to get news that a lot of people just disappeared, especially women, and a lot of women were raped. And my father, he was so concerned about it, and he decided me to leave. I still talking in English in present, and I just it's hard to realize that I have to talk in past continuous that. I had a job. I had a home. I say now very cruel thing, but I live in such situation for 1 month, and I get used to read bad news. I get used to feel that my family is in danger every day. I get used to cry. Like every day.
Something that's very abnormal becomes normal almost.
Yes, yes, you're right.
That's Dasha from Ukraine talking to Brian O'Connell in Blarney from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, young Padraig O'Callaghan is named as Limerick Person of the Year. Here's Gavin Jennings.
An 11-year-old boy who has provided inspirational and motivational videos during lockdown has been named Limerick Person of the Year. Padraig O'Callaghan from Knockanee in East Limerick, who has Down syndrome, won widespread popularity for his tips on how to stay positive during the COVID-19 pandemic. He began working on his videos called podcasts with his dad, Brian, who said it was a way to help him with his communication skills and confidence. The podcast now has 3 seasons. Here's a clip from season 1 featuring the return to school after lockdown.
Hi guys! Welcome to the Monday Motivation Podcast and welcome to my school. Today, I returned to school. In fact, in about 2 hours' time, this bell will ring and the whole school will walk through these gates once again. This yard will be filled with fun and laughter, and some degree of normality will return for us all. My advice today is to show some love to the teachers of Ireland. My school and our teachers have been amazing during lockdown. Thank you, Miss Donruss and Miss Maloney.
So Gavin spoke to very proud dad Brian about the podcast.
The podcast started actually, Gavin, by accident about 2-3 years ago now at this stage. We kind of fell into it during lockdown. I was looking for something, and as you quite rightly said, something to help with Padraig's communication skills, with his confidence, not that he lacks that in any way, and a kind of a way to keep him entertained, I suppose, during the first lockdown, you know. So we came up with this Monday Motivation podcast. I had maybe 4 or 5 ideas to start with, and quite honestly, it just took off. So we've kept going since. We're now in season 4, actually.
Oh, and Tell us, how did Padraig react to the news of being made Limerick Person of the Year?
Listen, Gavin, do you know something? All week we've tried to manage his expectations because, quite honestly, we didn't think we would win it. So basically, they brought up 12 monthly winners up on stage to take a bow, and then they would announce the yearly winner, if you like. So we had told him, look, you probably won't win, and it's great that you're there and you're nominated, and we're very, very proud of you. So we had absolutely no inkling. We were totally shocked, stunned, overwhelmed. Sometimes you hear these people who say they feel they weren't going to win, and then they pull a speech out of their back pocket. You know, that certainly was not us. we had nothing prepared at all. And he was overawed for the first time in, 3 years we're doing these. He was stuck for words. He was overawed, overcome with emotion, as we all were, to be honest with you. And the reception in the room which he received was just incredible.
We heard there his clip, his motivational clip ahead of heading back to school, and he's at school today. Of course, next week they'll be getting holidays again. How is he now after what was a very challenging 2 years for all boys and girls of his age?
It really was, Gavin, yeah. And look, I think if some people took hope or inspiration or motivation to overcome this the situation we find ourselves in, then it can only be a good thing. He's great. He's as easygoing or easygoing as they come. A great support network. The school in Knockanee National School have been absolutely amazing. All his friends, teachers, etc., as they have around the country for all the students, you know. So I think kids of that age, quite honestly, Gavin, will just take it in their stride. I think as you get older, maybe it's the 17, 18, 19-year-olds, quite honestly, who have suffered more than the 10, 11, 12-year-olds, you know, from a social aspect especially.
Fair play to him, Brian. You must be very proud of him.
Sure, listen, the words couldn't, I couldn't describe the sense of pride I feel, to be honest with you, you know. As I say, just to share the stage, I suppose, with so many winners, you know, and so many people held in such high regard around Limerick City and County and further afield, but to actually walk away with the award, it really was, on behalf of them, I suppose, it really was overwhelming, you know, so incredibly proud, yeah.
He's at school today. Does he know you're talking about him on the radio?
He doesn't know because this transpired very late last night and early this morning, so I missed him. But funnily enough, the Lee McCarthy Cup, as you know, Gavin, we're all Ireland champions on here in Limerick.
Yes, it has come to our attention, yes.
But the the cup is also going to school today, so it'll be great excitement in that game in the national school today.
Brian O'Callaghan talking about his son Pádraig, Limerick Person of the Year from Morning Ireland. Then Ryan Tuberty was also delighted that Pádraig was honoured because they go way back.
My old pal, Paddy, they mentioned him on Morning Ireland there with his dad. It was lovely to hear that. What they didn't mention was that Paddy was indeed my co-partner and dancing partner in the Late Late Toy Show this year, in last November, when we performed together with the song. Well, we didn't perform together. I was his wingman for the song Treat People With Kindness, which we danced to in the Olympia, and I spent a lot of time with Paddy as a result of that. And he is amazing. He has Down syndrome. He won widespread popularity for his tips on how to stay positive during the COVID-19 pandemic, as reported on RTE.ie by Cathy Halloran. And it's his podcasts, cleverly called, with his dad, Brian. And they've been doing great things to help him with his communication skills and confidence. But he was Limerick Person of the Month in January 2021. And today, at least yesterday, was named Limerick Person of the Year. So I'm delighted for him. I just posted up a nice photo of our time together up on Instagram. And wishing Paddy and his classmates, because I know he's in school at the moment, all the best and all the love.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the brilliant Derry Girls. The final series had its big premiere and there's plenty of excitement to come.
Well, the Derry Girls were back together last night in the city that inspired the drama for the premiere of the show's third and final series. Well, this season has been billed as a final love letter to the home city of its creator and writer, Lisa McGee. The Channel 4 comedy show was an instant hit when it was first screened back in 2018. It became one of the most watched television shows ever in Northern Ireland. It then went on to become a global phenomenon when it was picked up by the streaming giant Netflix, transforming how the city was seen right around the world. Well, Elaine McGee is a senior broadcast journalist with BBC Radio Foyle, and Elaine was at last night's special screening. Good morning, Elaine.
Oh, good morning, Claire. Good to talk to you.
You were treated to the first two episodes last night, but you can't tell us about them, can you?
No, I can't. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Yeah, they showed us the first two, Claire. But we are sworn to secrecy. We had to, you know, sign an embargo agreement with Channel 4. But you know what? I do understand why, Claire. You wouldn't want to give any of it away. Everyone's in for a big treat. Episode one, especially. You would ruin it for people if we were to talk about it. So I promise now, no spoilers at all. But yeah, what I will say is I absolutely loved it. The audience loved it. Big applause at the end. They're all back. They're in great form. Fantastic.
Well, you spoke to the show creator Lisa McGee and also the director Michael Lennox on the red carpet last night about how they hope the series is received and the possibility of a film, which we'd all love to see, a Derry Girls film. Let's hear what they had to say.
Really nervous. Like, this is the biggest thing for me, that it goes down well here. I think, you know, I'll relax a bit once I've sort of seen what happens tonight, if people laugh. So yeah, I'm very nervous now. I'll be fine. Afterwards, yeah, I'll have a glass of wine and I'll be grand.
You'll be playing.
Yeah.
What do you think Derry Girls has given Derry the success of it?
I mean, I don't know. They've just really... I always feel weird answering that because I feel like the city's given my show a lot with the characters and the people and their sense of humour here. So I just love that they've got behind it and they've been such a great support. And we couldn't have done it without that support. We just couldn't have made Derry Girls without the support of the city.
What was it like directing it all, Michael?
Oh, it was amazing. You know, it's a privilege. Like, you dream as a director to get, you know, an amazing script. You know, that's what you hope for. And I'm a selfish director. I've been able to do all the episodes, you know, Derry Girls, and been on this journey for the last few years. So it's just a privilege to finally get season 3, you know, out there and come to the end of this journey.
Could we be getting a film?
I just need to lie down now after this. We'll see how people...
Michael looks open to it there now.
Yeah, Michael, well, Michael.
I'm open to any Lisa McGee project.
Michael wants to make movies all the time.
Yeah,
so that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know. We'll see. I think we've ended it in a really beautiful place and I hope all the people agree, but you know, I'd love to wait until the final goes out and see what people think.
I'm smiling, Elaine, at Lisa's nerves. You know, she has this international, worldwide hit on her hands and she's nervous going into the premiere. But also, interestingly, they're not ruling out a film. Do you think there's anywhere left to go with these characters?
Yeah, I definitely think there's something there, Claire, no doubt. They didn't rule anything out about a film. it does feel like there could be more. There's definitely an appetite about it. And anyone I asked about it last night, and you heard Lisa there, is very much, look, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. In terms of the TV show, I think it might be done. We get up as far as the Good Friday Agreement in this series. It does feel that they've taken them to the stage in their lives, maybe as far as they can go. And we have a beautiful ending, as Lisa was saying, to look forward to. Now, there's a very popular podcast called Talking Derry Girls. And one of the presenters, Pauline, was saying, wouldn't it be lovely to revisit them, you know, in their mid-20s to see what they're all up to, which would be class. But look, it's all in Lisa McGee's hands, isn't it?
And you spoke to a few others now about the possibility of a film as well. Saoirse Monica Jackson, who plays Erin, Jamie Lee O'Donnell, who plays Michelle. What did they have to say?
Yeah, it was lovely talking to them, actually. Like, Saoirse and Jamie Lee, they're the only two real-life Derry girls in the group, so you could really see what last night meant to them. There was a lovely moment with Saoirse, actually, when she was saying, you know, she went to Derry's Omniplex as a teenager, and then she was standing there last night in this beautiful white dress, and all her family and friends there. There was a lovely moment when her granny came over and gave her a big hug. You know, she's there for a premiere. And she said as well, you know, too, when she embarked on an acting career, she didn't think that she would have a role where she could speak in her own accent and tell the story of her city. You know, and look where it's led them, their careers, like all of them. Like, look at Nicola Coughlan, you know, they've skyrocketed really since the start of Derry Girls. So maybe as time goes on, it would be harder to get them back together. But who knows? Hopefully the Derry Girls door won't close completely.
Yeah, what a moment in their careers, though. And Jamie Lee also told you she hasn't seen any of the new series because she wanted to experience as the fans will at the same time.
Yeah, she said she was so buzzed about it. And again, like, they've been so successful. But Jamie Lee was saying, you know, I get so nervous around press. And I was like, really? you know, they've come so far, but they're still so them. And I think that is what's so key to Derry Girls.
Yeah, just looking back at the huge moments for the series over the last two. So you've the creation of the mural in the city of the Derry Girls, the name checking of the show in The Simpsons. But the actors, you know, and even Lisa herself, they all seem to be a bit in shock about their success over the first two seasons. Do you think they get it a bit more this time around, Elaine?
Yeah, you know, like the Simpsons tribute, like that really, like that was unreal. It really sealed Derry Girls' cultural icon status, I think. And I don't think anyone involved with it could have predicted when it started what was to come. Like, I even have the little Smash Hits cover that they brought back to promote Series 3. I mean, it's unreal. Now, there's definitely still a nervousness there, though, Claire, to how Series 3 will be received. But I think, you know, you think they could be a bit more relaxed, but you heard Lisa McGee there. It doesn't get any easier putting out a comedy series where the Troubles is the backdrop about your home city. Like, can you imagine?
Yeah.
But going on what we did see last night now, I don't think they have anything to worry about.
Excellent. That's Elaine McGee from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, a Lady Thatcher, no, not that one, Marika Bean was telling Ryan Tuberty about her life leaving Holland to live in Ireland and the age-old skill of thatching roofs.
I need to kind of, with you, I need to go back to you being around 15 years old or thereabouts in the Netherlands. You decide, yeah, I'm out of here. And you got a job on a fishing boat of some sort in Scotland. So what were you doing on the boat?
Fishing,
oh, God.
tailing prawns mostly.
Yes.
Most of the time. And that's what I was doing.
Yeah, okay.
Bit of adventure
in your life. And the boat then lands in Dublin. What happens next?
No, the boat was actually, it was based in Scotland, but we were going between Northern Ireland and Scotland. So
okay.
I went over to Northern Ireland and then hitched the lift down to Dublin, meaning to go to Galway, and I got a lift from a man from Loughrea.
Great.
Who brought me down to Loughrea and then said, would you like to come down to the house and freshen up and meet my neighbours?
And who are the neighbours?
And the neighbours were three bachelor farmers, 60, 70 and 80 years of age, the Fahas or the Fahis.
Were they the brothers or...?
Three brothers, yeah.
Okay. And
married. Yeah. Mad for music. Mad for life. So I said, and he said, oh, yeah, they're such interesting characters. You should really meet them. So I walked up the road and met them. And indeed, they were very interesting and very nice men to talk to. And, had a great time. So... months later, decided to visit them again at Christmas.
Okay.
And, never left.
You never looked back after that?
No. I stayed living with them then for about 3.5, 4 years.
When you say living with them, were you in their house?
Well, sort of, more or less. They had one of them, they were living in an old thatched house, and they had the county council used to provide people in thatched houses mostly with sort of a prefab back in the day, in the early 80s, I'm talking.
Mm.
So I was living in the prefab because they were only using it for, as a cattle shed, really. They pulled the toilet out of it and they stored their fodder, their bags and nuts in it. So I moved into that. And, yeah.
You make yourself sound like a calf.
No. It's just a proper little prefab.
All right.
No running water or anything, but it was fine.
And what year are we talking about? What type of, what part of
that? It was early 80s. I'd say could be 83, 84, thereabouts.
And the brothers introduced you to thatching, is that right?
That's right, yeah. One of them used to be the sort of the thatcher of the house, and he used to keep the roof in good condition, and he was doing a few jobs for other people, and he injured himself, so they thought it was a great plan to introduce me to it.
Yeah.
And they showed me how to make scallops, which are the fixings that you use, and draw bundles of straw. And before I knew it, I was on top of the roof thatching their roof.
How long does it take to thatch a roof?
Well, at that time, now you wouldn't do the whole roof, especially not their house was in such bad condition. You'd only patch where it started to leak.
Okay.
Just strokes here and there and patches. And so there were different times. It's not like now where you do a whole house in one go or half a house. But back then, mostly people lived from year to year, did bits and pieces on their houses as it needed to be done.
And you ultimately became a thatcher.
Then I became a thatcher, you could say, yeah. I was completely fascinated by the whole thing because I wasn't from a farming or a thatching background, and I thought it was so interesting that you could make a roof out of local material, you know, sourced locally, hazel, grown locally, the straw, and you just made it into bundles and brought it up the roof, and you had your roof covering. And yeah, from the minute I was up on the roof, I was fascinated by it. So, but back then there was no money, nobody had money, and thatching wasn't a great career really.
Mm.
So I was doing bits and bobs everywhere. I was doing thatching everywhere, and I was also doing other work everywhere because you couldn't make a living off it. And yeah, that's how it sort of all started. And then I got married into my 20s. I got married to a reed thatcher and got introduced to a different material, reed.
And Marika spoke about marrying another thatcher.
I married a thatcher, yeah.
And how did you meet him?
Well, that's a really long story, but we used to know each other as teenagers. We were both runaways, really.
Okay.
And that's how we met up. And then years later, we met up again and we got married.
You got married and had some children together. And
and we had children and the whole lot. And then about, I suppose, 18... Yeah, so I was only allowed to be a sidekick, really, and doing all the the groundwork and the scallops. And even though I had been a thatcher in my own right before that. But, so anyway, about 18... 20 years ago, maybe, he decided he was not interested in doing it anymore and he gave it up.
Yes.
So I didn't want to give it up. And I stayed going. And ultimately, I did an apprenticeship to gain a bit of self-confidence. And I've been thatching ever since.
You must be one of the few thatchers. I was going to say female, male thatchers, but just thatchers in Ireland. Is it common? Are there many people left doing it?
Not that many people doing it. There's a good few in the West here that I know of.
Okay.
But not that many women. I only know of one other lady thatcher, but sure, I don't know everybody, so there could be more out there. But as far as I know, there's another lady up in Sligo.
Okay. I would have, obviously, like everyone else in the country, you pass by a thatched cottage. It always looks very romantic. And it always looks very beautiful. It always looks like artistic and kind of old-fashioned. But people used to say, "Oh no, the you know, rodents will live in the among the thatching in the roof and all these kind of." Is that a myth, or you know, are they?
Well, it's definitely a myth when it comes to reed thatching, reed as a material, because there's not that much interest in living in reed because there's no food for them in it. But in the past, you know, just in the straw, there would have been mice. Mostly because there's always a bit of grain left in it.
I see.
And they would have smelled the grain, I'm sure, but from living on the thatch, it's definitely not. I don't think you get many more mice and rats in thatch than you would get in a normal house or a normal roof.
Okay. And you tend to use reeds, is that right?
Well, I prefer straw, but yeah. In the West now, it's 90% con reeds because the unavailability of the straw and the modern farm techniques have unfortunately led to the demise of straw, so it's nearly all reed at the moment.
And in my uneducated mind, reeds are common and everywhere and easy to come by, but I think I may be wrong on that one. Where do you get your reeds from?
Reed is very common. It does grow everywhere there is water, really, but in order for it to be harvested, you know, it has to be properly managed and it has to be cut on a yearly basis and it has to be dried in a certain manner. So there's a lot more to it, to the harvesting of the reed, than just going out there and harvesting it. Now, I'm sure you can do it and you can use it in its original form, but you get a much better and nicer finish when you're using properly managed and cut reed that's straight and stored in under dry conditions.
Marika Bean from the Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the morning, the coffee cup levy of 20 cents on each single-use cup is on the way. Reporter Evelyn O'Rourke was taking a look at cup rental schemes and coffee culture.
And Evelyn, there's general agreement that disposable coffee cups, they cause litter, they're a blight on our streets, but there are mixed views on the best way to tackle the problem.
Well, I mean, of course, Claire, because, you know, before, you know, back before the pandemic, there was this acknowledgement by most of us that the littering problem was huge with single-use coffee cups. And coffee shops were offering good deals, like if you brought in your reusable cup. Then COVID happened. That, was, of course, was no longer an option for customers or staff. So single-use cups came back in. But now, as things begin to return to some sort of a normality, the question of what to do with these pesky cups is back. And coffee is big business. I mean, last year, research carried out by Bruce Smartley found that Dublin is the second most coffee-obsessed capital in the world, with 181 coffee shops per 100,000 people in Dublin. And, of course, that's great news for people in the industry, but it means it's generating a huge amount of environmentally unfriendly waste. And this levy that we're talking about, it's part of a move, really, to reduce waste and influence behaviour through the Circular Economy Bill. But there is a wide range of reaction to it, inside and outside the industry, as they all come up with different ways to grapple, really, with these challenges.
So you started by visiting a coffee shop. They take their waste responsibilities very seriously. They don't even serve takeaway coffees in single-use cups from Monday to Friday. This is at Bread 41. They rent their cups out. Tell us more.
This is a really popular place, Bread 41, and I started, yes, by visiting Owen Klusky there in Pierce Street, and he's made that decision. They don't serve takeaway coffee cups on Monday to Friday, and he's encouraging customers to use their own reusable coffee cup or indeed sit in and have their coffee there. And he has a scheme also where you can rent a cup from Bread 41 for €1, and he is a passionate advocate for zero waste for environmental reasons, but he also says that makes sense commercially too. So here you'll get a sense of Owen, full of passion, full of ideas at the busy Bread 41 store, explaining why they're offering a cup rental scheme, having offered compostable cups in the past.
I was spending €90,000 a year on compostable cups. Let's just put it into perspective. The coffee's now €3.20. It was about 28 cents a cup. Let's put in the machine cost, the maintenance on the machine, the person behind the machine, the bean, the milk. Milk has gone up 17% in the last 6 months. So everything's on the up. So how do we save where we need to save and then stop waste? And as soon as you identify waste in the building and you open your eyes to waste, you look at everything around you going, God, there's more waste. And it's a great journey to be on. So there needs to be a whole approach here, and it's not just a coffee cup levy. Everyone knows, and this is why the pushback will be big against it. It's 20 cents on a coffee cup. What's going to be next? And they will listen. they're going to start taxing bins. Bins are going to go up. So I think it's important to, you know, save where you can save.
And how many coffee cups were you selling?
So we were selling in the coffee shop a day, pre-pandemic, we were doing 500 cups. I'd say the majority of them, 200, 250, were going out the door. And that dropped
to 60. The others were reusable or people sitting in?
People sitting in. People be sitting in having coffees.
And what did you serve those in?
In a mug, just the standard mugs, you know. So it went from averaging about 200 cups a day down to 60. So we were losing 140 cups in perspective. That was about 480 euros a day we were losing on coffee.
With the policy that you had of I'm not selling you this cup of coffee.
Yeah, with the policy I had. And then we went through different stages of looking for the right cup to use for reusable. We had our own sort of these, we had these own flasks, you know, and we'd rent it out for €2.50 and they just weren't coming back. We're giving a reusable cup for a euro out. Like we gave out 1,600 of them. I was like, how many have we got back in? Because sometimes when you look at it, if it's a euro, I was saying, is it too cheap? Are they just getting that and then putting that in the bin? Because then I'm creating a plastic waste. So you're like, the onus is back on you. So many.
What's coming back? I'm at the edge of my seat. How many are you getting back?
Yeah, no, listen, honestly, we are averaging a day, we'll get 15 back. And if we're putting out 150, we get 15. But what the cup we use, to go cup, is used in multiple locations around Dublin. So they can bring that coffee cup back to another store and get their money back. So we're tracking that because I have this thing about waste. I do not want to be creating a plastic waste and I don't want to see them in bins. So listen, it's good and it's working. And I think a lot of coffee shops are going to get on the same page.
Owen Klusky there, and Evelyn also spoke to another coffee shop owner.
Yes, Colin Harmon from the very popular chain 3FE. He was in his Grand Canal store the other day, Claire, when I met him. And he supports the decisions like the levy. It's important to him. But he also thinks that coffee's a bit of a lightning rod, that's an easy target. And that while we need to be really careful and more careful about how we dispose of coffee cups, he says, look, there are other environmental issues and it's going to take political will too. So here, Colin Harmon from 3FE tells me more.
We're in favour of this happening, and the good thing about it is that it's difficult for businesses to make decisions that are environmentally friendly if they have a big impact on them commercially when other people aren't doing it. So the fact that everybody has to do the same thing is a great thing for us. We're all doing it together, we'll all figure out a system, that's brilliant. I would worry that people are going to overestimate the impact this is going to have. There's massive issues in this country with creating pollution and dealing with rubbish and how that should be.
So why this? Why does this keep coming back as the big urban issue?
I don't know. It becomes a bit of a lightning rod for a lot of political issues, and whenever there's a budget, people look at the price of a cappuccino, and coffee cups are very visible. They see them in the streets. I think coffee's a bit of an easy target as well. It's seen as maybe a little elitist or something, or like a new generation thing. Most coffee shops, and I think that's been proven over the years, are very eco-minded. Like there's a lot of sustainability.
And are your customers looking for it? I mean, is it something they ask you about?
We sold the first keep cup in Ireland in 2009, and I remember a woman used it. The other customers would kind of giggle at her. They offered me the distribution here and I said, no, you're grand. So sold a few of them, that took a while. And fast forward, I think that was the worst business mistake I ever made.
Colin Harmon from Evelyn O'Rourke's report from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.